guys, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So here we are, aspirational vision, composting tyranny into nutrient for democracy. We just put that on our altar of desirable mystery. How shall we craft redemptive Act 5 from our current Act 4? Remember, Act 4 is a tragedy. It's where you encounter evil. Act 5 is the redemptive renaissance. So, how shall we craft redemptive Act 5 from our current Act 4 of cruel carnage, ransacking? The word comes from Old Norse and means to pillage, ransacking community. So we welcome Henry Giroux, indefatigable teammate, critique, deeply dedicated cultural trickster, translator of complex liberating pedagogy into accessible vernacular, always the micro to the macro, and ladling out of the cauldron redemptive strategy and vision to navigate through this dangerous crackpot tyranny time. Education as essential to good citizenship, essential to democracy. He's a prodigious contributor, co-authored over 65 books, Henry, oh my God, articles and lectures. And then on his splendid website, that again, just think of this as a crucial navigational teammate. His website is henryagiroux.com. That's henryagiroux.com. Many great quotes. Here's two. No one is better than Henry Giroux at analyzing the truly dangerous threats to our society. We gotta know. He punctures our delusions, a wonderful word. Deludo means out of the game, and offers us a compelling and enlightened vision of a better way, says Bob Herbert. John Strepling says, Henry Giroux is one of the singular intellects in contemporary life, a sane, compassionate, and fierce voice against the society of domination, inequality, and the madness of ruthless imperialist conquest. Welcome, Henry.
Hi, Caroline. How are you?
All the better for reading your splendid book, which we can let people know about that. And talking to you, I remember so many smart things you said 50 years ago, just for the fun of it, like saying that the only true scene in Star Wars is the bar scene. Anyway, I keep these bon mots and quips of yours from, I think it's 50 years ago, Henry, that we first met. So here we are.
50 years ago, and here we are, still fighting.
And here we are, yeah, still fighting, dancing, whatever words we want to use. Again, this is a democratic show, you can go anywhere you want, but what do you feel are the most important skills that we all want to hone to be participatory Earth citizens at this dangerous time?
I think that one of the things that we need to be able to do is we need to be able to recognize that the ability to read the culture critically and to use a language that does that in ways in which people can recognize themselves is really the basis for not only agency, which is being wiped out, depoliticized, and rendered dead under forms of historical, political, and social amnesia, but it also makes us realize that we don't wage this fight alone. That the question of agency has to be linked to the question of solidarity, and it has to be linked to the question of justice. And I think in some way, we use the metaphor dancing. We need to dance with a sense of community and a sense of possibility in which critique is valuable, but it's never enough. And I think that one of the things that we're fighting in a way that we have never fought before is a form of depoliticization that has taken place under a kind of latent colonialism, which is now really gangster capitalism, that does everything it can to prevent people from translating private issues into larger social considerations. And that creates enormous despair because it makes us all feel as if we're alone. And finally, you couple that with the fact that the spaces in which people come together, are being eliminated. And the institutions that enable people to think critically and to in some way assess what it means to imagine a future different from the present are disappearing. They're under assault. I mean, I couldn't help but find it hard to believe that, you have an administration so overtly fascist, so unapologetically cruel, so unapologetically corrupt, that it actually issues a mandate to a place like Harvard University, which is far from a model of what a university should be like. They did give us the Iraqi war, didn't they? But it wants to take over their admissions process. It wants to control their curriculum, and it wants to control their hiring process. I mean, have we heard this before? Did we not hear it in Argentina? Did we not hear it in Nazi Germany? Did we not hear it in states where young students were being thrown from planes because they were dissidents? I mean, what does it mean to live in a society when young people who literally represent the future wake up one morning going to school and protesting against a genocidal war, look up in the top of buildings, and they see sharpshooters on their campus? Or they're beaten because they basically believe that justice matters. Or they're being told that if they write an op-ed in a school newspaper, they can be abducted and sent to some place in El Salvador where, you know, where justice has died and torture has become normalized.
Right. Because we also, of course, want to understand that this is, you know, anything that's anywhere is everywhere, right? So the alliance, Trump's alliance with Orban, right? And Hungary had two CPAC conventions, the, you know, whatever it is, the political action, the Conservative Political Action Committee. I've been to two of them a long time ago, not right lately, but it's like they have CPAC over there. And Orban, a Hungarian, deeply informed ally of mine, says, and remember, Orban is a big fan of staged assassinations. You know, he goes, whenever you need support. Anyway, so we just put that to one side. But it is everywhere.
But I think, yeah. I'm sorry.
No, you go.
I'm sorry. Where Orban is particularly dangerous and particularly revealing is, remember, he becomes a model for talking about democracy as being unworkable because it allows mixed races. I mean, he's actually said this.
Right.
I mean, and I think that what that brings to the forefront here is not just simply that he creates a model that is authoritarian and wipes out the media, puts his allies in control of all the institutions that basically produce a kind of sordid public consciousness. But what's particularly interesting about Orban is that in some way he represents an unapologetic defense of fascism. I mean, that's what he basically does. And he does it by resurrecting something that we don't talk about in the U.S. as much as we should, which is white supremacy. I mean, this is a reengineering of the notion of citizenship to basically include not only, you know, not only white Christian nationalists, to say the least, but it also redefines a new, an upgrade in what we call the politics of disposability, which now has become increasingly normalized in ways that are almost unimaginable in the United States. So Orban has really been fundamental in this because Orban represents a new entry into fascism. It's not done with the army. It's not done with soldiers marching and taking over buildings. It's done by undermining the democratic process and then using that process to basically generate an authoritarian society.
Yes. That is true. And also, I think for all of us, and you as a deep delving historian, you know, this current, you know, started a long time ago. And even if we just go back some generations, like what you're talking about, Orban, well, Elon Musk's, you know, grandfather was, you know, moved to South Africa because he was like, technocracy, that's the way. We want technocracy to take over. Democracy is useless. There we go. And white supremacy, yes, and I'm a Nazi, and I'm going to South Africa. So these beings have been visualizing this for a long time. And I think, you know, in the part of the election recently and everything, it's like we underestimated the long-term dedication.
Sorry.
What?
No, I completely agree with you. That's insightful, brilliant, and it's something that suggests you can't undo historical memory. You know, you can't talk about Trump as a personality. You know, you can't talk about him as some screwball that we can sort of claim is just excess and is psychologically damaged, as so many people do. You know, Primo Levi got it right. I mean, Hannah Arendt got it right. fascism has a long legacy, and it started long before the Nazis and long before what happened in Argentina and long before what happened in Chile. I mean, you can date it back to slavery. You can date it back to Jim Crow. I mean, how many theorists have said they really want to talk about fascism? It doesn't begin in Nazi Germany. It really begins in the United States with eugenics. It begins with slavery. It begins with the internment of the Japanese. There's a long hidden history there, but in the past, everything was done in some way to suggest that was part of an exception. You know, that the United States is exceptional, and that was just something that shouldn't happen. We can apologize, but that's not true, of course, at all. I mean, it basically has grown. It's metastasized. That kind of white racism, that kind of ultra-nationalism, that kind of cultural cruelty has been around for a long time. And I think that it really begins to emerge in the United States in the 1980s under neoliberalism, under this attack on government, the attack on care, social responsibility, the attack on any notion of justice that basically gets in the way of gangster capitalism. And I think that that offers something that then leads to something that we need to understand. And that is, when gangster capitalism, when neoliberalism cannot justify itself anymore, when it can't talk about social equality, when it can't talk about rising people up from you know, the bottom, offering more jobs, it moves somewhere else. It becomes unapologetically fascist. Then it blames blacks. Then it for inequality. Then it blames brown people. Then it blames immigrants. And then it does away completely with any notion that it needs to engage in a legitimation, in solving the legitimation crisis. And that's where we are. We have a long history of repression in the United States, covered over for the most part. The claim being that capitalism and democracy are the same thing, that'll take us to the promised land. It didn't happen. It took us to hell. And I think that hell is now at its end point.
Yeah. And I just want to go back to, you know, the dementors, the dementors of doom, the Elon Musk heritage, and we underestimated because Trump was a buffoon. How could anybody possibly? Oh my God! Because the Opus Dei, the kind of black magic part of the Steve Bannon part of the church, they visualize, they practice imagining this. They've been practicing imagining this. So it comes back to us, you know, all power to the imagination, to also craft our desirable vision. I love somebody, there was a study in England that said, to the degree to which people are ironic is the degree to which they can have compassion. And I like it because it's surprising, like what? But to be ironic, and you have this skill, is to hold at least two stories at once, what is and what should be, which we got to do, right? And what is and what people are pretending it is, also the bogus directive, you know. So, and then to be compassionate is to hold more and more stories at once. But I love the liberating as irony to hold this vision, you know. And what you do, you know, and what we're all aspiring to do, which is to hold the desirable vision, what is and what should be. You know, and even the imaginary shadow government, you know, comprised not even necessarily of humans, but, you know, wolves as head of the Department of Education, something. But yes, so there is that. And then, you know, just for the quirkiness of it all, I went to New College in Florida, in Sarasota, Florida, which you mentioned, you know, and you quote Chris Hedges too. So New College in the beginning, I mean, I went there. I didn't last long because I was headed for other things. But it was a really great experiment of progressive, tolerant, inclusive, you know, wonderfulness. Really, it was very, very smart. And then, of course, DeSantis, you know, stripped it and put in, you know, it's ruined, you know. And then just to toss back to you, you quote Chris Hedges saying, "Not one university president has denounced Israel's destruction of every university in Gaza, or called for the end of cruel carnage, or sanctions and divestment from Israel, but groveling before wealthy donors and weapons manufacturers." So that this is important, you know, the expediency of money, and I want to just see before us all, we have a giant cauldron. What do we want to throw into the cauldron? I think expediency, like the Avella Airlines going, oh, it's good business to fly hapless people to El Salvador. It's like, no. Don't you think that making tyranny too expensive is an important part of our strategy?
I think that making normalizing tyranny is the issue that we should address. And I think that one of the things that you're suggesting, and I use a different language for this, is that we need to take culture seriously. I mean, culture matters. I mean, cultures are where identities are, where language is produced, where power is made visible or are basically erased. Culture is the place where identities are constructed. Culture is the place where civic imagination either lives or dies. And I think for a long time, the left has failed to understand that. And I think that when you talk about the Bannons or the Stephen Millers or the Elon Musk, they understand something about culture. They understand that it's absolutely the place where politics has found its grounding, particularly right-wing politics. And I think that what they also understand is that education is central to politics. And I think that too many on the left have been so absorbed by the assumption that only economic structures matter and that that's the only way you can talk about domination, is that they've really lost the battle over ideas and the construction of what I would call not just the language of possibility, but what I would call the language of the civic imagination. You know, the ability to imagine solidarity, the ability to imagine a country different than what we have, the ability to imagine that history, as Marx said, is open and can be changed. And I think that when you live in a country that seems to suggest, particularly in the way it's pushed in the cultural sphere, where everything is privatized, and you lead people to believe that all modes of responsibility are simply personal responsibility, you get a lot of despair, and you get a lot of cynicism, and you get a lot of hopelessness. That's a form of depoliticization, and it's basically an education. It's a function of an educational apparatus, as C. Wright Mills talked about, that in many ways has come to shape and dominate a global culture. And until we can understand how crucial education is to politics, if not the central issue, then we're not going to be able to resurrect terms like civic literacy. We're not going to be able to understand what pedagogy means as a form of empowerment. We're not going to be able to understand what it means to produce identities that in some way can recognize in a different language the need to govern rather than to learn how to, the need to learn how to govern rather than be governed. So this question of agency, subjectification, education, and politics all of a sudden is taking a very different turn because the objective conditions are becoming so cruel, so overwhelming, that they're touching people's everyday lives. Look, I'm not a great fan of Rachel Maddow, but I'll say this for her.
She's been doing great, though. She's been doing good work lately.
She's been doing good work. I mean, what she did in the first 100 days that nobody in the life press did. Every night we saw instances of resistance at the local level. She talked about the issues that were motivating people. She talked about the need for mass movements. She talked about the need for updated forms of resistance, and she talked about education. And I thought, wow.
She did great. Yes, we have, everybody's befoiled, okay, but she did great. And also her podcasts on the history of tyranny in America, good.
Yeah, the thing about Rachel Maddow that I think we need to understand, you build on the conditions that other people create. You've known that for 50 years, and I think so have I. But I want to say this in light of this conversation. Look, if we can't talk about inequality, and we can't talk about education, understand how they basically interact. If we can't talk about the need to recognize that capitalism is the antithesis of democracy, we can't recognize that we need to support an educational system that promotes anti-capitalist values, we're dead. It's over.
And so secondly,
it seems to me, I want to reinforce that point by making the claim that this attack that we see in this administration on education signifies more than anything how powerfully dangerous education can be. And I think we lose sight of that. We simply talk about the domination, but we don't talk about why it's happening. Far more important than Elon Musk. I mean, if they can close down the institutions of education that are critical, that are empowering, that allow people to understand that power needs to be held accountable, that's dangerous. That's dangerous. And I think Maddow, in her own ways, has made that clear.
Yeah, and I want to go back to two short things. One, if we look up culture in a good etymological dictionary, the first three definitions are all what do we grow, you know, in a petri dish, you know, whatever. And then way down the list, only by analogy, is what do we encourage, what qualities are we encouraging growing in our community? So culture, really important. And then we're going to just have a very brief 1 minute public service announcement from Neil Green. Just it's a great little thing. What do politics have to do with me? So here's this short public service announcement clip.
I have a lot to say about politics. Some people don't want to talk about politics. They're like, NATO, why do you got to talk about politics? What do politics have to do with me? I'm not an immigrant or a black person or a Muslim or a Jew or a gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender or a woman or an old person or a young person. Or a student, or a union member, or artist, or journalist, or scientist, or public employee. I don't breathe the air or drink the water. I don't live in a coastal region that'll be affected by sea level rise, or an arid region that'll be affected by drought or fire. I don't like chocolate, wine, or coffee, or other commodities that will no longer be available due to climate change. I'm not mentally ill, pregnant, disabled, or currently being shot at, so. What do politics have to do with me?
It's a great little clip. All right, and just I just wanted to put that in there too, as part of culture and part of a culture of humor and satire and critique as well, and drawing upon our ancestors, the Celts thought that satire would bring down the unruly, power abusing tyrant, and we go all of the, well, we want to hone all of our skills, right? And what you're putting on our work table is, can we discern the difference that we must between a cult and a community, right? Because cult is the toxic mimic of community. And we have a cult, and you know, the Israeli government has become a cult, and the American government has become a cult, which is where people abandon and outsource their autonomy. Here, take it away. You know, and so community, and I love that you know, referenced early in your book, David Graeber. I love David Graeber. You know, leaning more anarcho myself. But remember, and so I guess you read The Dawn of Everything.
I think that when I hear this, I think to myself, you know, one of the things we don't talk about any longer is about the politics of disappearance, you know, and erasure. And what he was talking about, and it's brilliant, right, is that what gets erased is a certain kind of attentiveness to solidarity and to history. What gets erased is historical memory. I mean, what gets erased is what I call the totality, the ability to take these different pieces and put them all together and connect them and to realize that they're part of a larger system. What gets erased is the neoliberal notion that all activity has to be divorced from social responsibility. And I think that's a massive form of depoliticization. I mean, it's funny and it's sad, because in many ways, what's at risk here is not just simply that saying that politics doesn't matter. Saying it doesn't matter is really a way of affirming not just cynicism, but the lack of social responsibility, the indifference to solidarity, and the indifference to collective justice. But what really is at work here is the belief that politics is toxic, that relations of power don't matter, that those larger systems that we talk about that are so overwhelmingly powerful and dangerous. I mean, I don't lose, you know, when I think about Gaza, I wrote a chapter in that book about Gaza when it was dangerous to write a chapter about Gaza. And I focused on children, because the massive deaths, genocidal deaths taking place against women and children in Gaza, it seemed to me if that couldn't move and in some way incite a public consciousness, we really had to raise serious questions about what actually killed the ability to respond to others in a way with care and compassion and a sense of justice. And there was one instance in that book where a young boy, God, I'm sorry, I forgot his name, you know, whose parents had been killed, was in a tent on an IV, and they bombed the tent. And there was a video appeared of this kid burning in his tent. And then you think of the language that was used by the Israelis to justify that. All kids grow into terrorists. Palestinians are animals. And it goes on and on. we need to mow the lawn. And then, of course, it accelerated to the ultimate ideal of capitalism, it's in its myopic delusions about turning Palestinians and Gaza into sort of like a resort area, and that ethnic cleansing really doesn't matter if we have to do that. And I guess what we have to ask ourselves here, and it's one of the questions I tried to ask in the book, and that is, how do you talk about the collapse of conscience at a scale that basically reinforces, legitimates, and updates the terror of neo-fascism? How do you do that? And where does liberalism come into this? How do we talk about liberals? How do we talk about those ideologies that in some way claim that they're morally offended by what they see, but still supports a state that, you know, is the largest arms dealer in the world and basically has a morality that's comparable to what I would call, you know, people who have blood in their mouths. And so that's the question I'm dealing with, right? And that's the question I'm trying to explore via a different kind of language. We need a new language to be able to grapple with some of this stuff. The old language doesn't work for me. So that we talk about blood in their mouths, or we talk about politics of disappearance, we talk about terminal exclusions. I mean, these are language that need to, in some way, create a kind of awakening, an anarcho awakening in some way that in which language doesn't just become moving and emotive, but it offers a different picture that allows us to redirect our attention to the dangers that we face.
Yes, now language is agile and inventive, and language really one of the first great technologies of cooperation, the power of words, right? And, you know, again, we are language crafting beings, and so the language, and then we have a few minutes before our break, and then we'll, on the other side of it, we'll deal even more deeply with language. But right, you said writing about Gaza was dangerous. Well, you've been teaching in Canada for a while, right? So it was, and three of our anti-authoritarian professors, you know, Timothy Snyder and company, have just moved to Canada. So it was dangerous in Canada for you to write about Gaza some years back.
Yeah, it is dangerous in Canada to write about Gaza. And as a matter of fact, I have a center called the Center for Knowledge and the Public Interest. It's now under attack.
And I have
an administration, somebody in the administration is trying to eliminate it and eliminate me. It's still in process. But none of us are safe, right? I mean, we're not safe. I understand Snyder. I could certainly understand Snyder, and coming here. And as a matter of fact, I'm delighted I'm in Canada and not in the United States. And I can't go to the United States for 4 years because I'm convinced I'd be arrested. There are some liberal policies here that matter, and so you can't speak up. But I think people like you and people like me and my partner, you know, what we writing today is dangerous. It's dangerous, and you know, Arendt once said all thinking is dangerous, and she's right. And I think that we've now moved into an era where the possibility of using language to hold power accountable, never mind reconsidering identities that are far different than the neoliberal savage subject, is dangerous. And I think we have to be aware of that. You know, nothing is guaranteed anymore in terms of safety, given the rise of global fascism.
Right. And also community. I mean, we're seeing, you know, I mean, appalling things in what you mentioned in Gaza and what you mentioned on the streets here and kids being, you know, handcuffed and or their parents taken and they're left alone in cars, you know, but the community, you know, on a number of, you know, and Rachel has been covering this, but she's gone for the moment. But the community going, you get back, shame, shame. And in some cases, just forcing ICE back. You know, so community arising, you know, is part of like this arising. You know, your book is called The Burden of Conscience. May there be a collective community arousing of decency, you know. And it is, yeah. It is like the dock workers in France who are refusing to load weapons onto boats that are taking machine gun ammunition to Israel. That's like, we're not loading it. And we go, yes, good France. And in tout le monde, right, everyone just refuse, withdraw, you know, deserters from the military following their own wilderness path is an image that's strong in the collective. And we go, right, so there's that. So we're going to take a very short musical break to rouse our spirits. Our splendid guest is Henry Giroux. His website is henryagiroux, GIROUX.com. Excellent resource. We're going to play just a little bit of the Dirty Dozen Brass Band to bring in a little bit of New Orleans that really knows how to woof in the presence of tyranny, just to rouse our spirits. And we'll be right back after this rousing, tap your feet, move around from the Dirty Dozen Brass Band. Here we go. There we go, from the spirit of feisty and jazz and anarchism that bubbles out of New Orleans, just a little bit of like woof to keep us going. This is Caroline Casey, the Visionary Activist Show. Our guest this hour is Henry Giroux, long time deep delving, written over 65 books or co-authored them too. It's amazing your prodigious discipline, Henry. And you always, you attribute also to your wonderful, wonderful wife who keeps you steady, right?
Yeah, she sure does. She's
That's wonderful. She's your rock, right? And so that idea of, you know, yes, cahooting and partnering and being more effective because you've written or co-authored 65 books, it's like a very impressive. So so Henry Giroux, so back to yes, you wanting to say something now? Yes.
Oh. No, I was saying I've produced over 81 books. I've just passed my age.
Oh wow, that's amazing! That's amazing. So 81. You've written 81 books or co-authored them.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. All right, we're inspired. We're inspired. We want to feel the discipline.
In fact, I'm thinking about Philip Roth, who said that at some point you write so many books, you think, okay, I'm not going to write anymore, and I'm just going to go back and read them all and see if it was worth it.
Right. Well, the one that you sent me, The Burden of Conscience, right, it's you wrote it and I guess revised it. You know, it was 2016. Now it's up to now with the even greater, you know, tyranny. But yes, but then again, the rousing, which we do see, you know, and again, you know, it's like as things are destroyed, you know, we go, well, all we have is us. Right. I mean, in the sense of community. And now we're into the realm of mutual aid and who brought what. And that's why I so love David Graeber, who spent 10 years with his co-author writing The Dawn of Everything, the history of human society and gathering, and starting with the Pleistocene, going, remember, we have evidence in the Pleistocene of people tending each other, right? Mutual aid. And Margaret Mead said she knows there's a civilization when she finds the remains of somebody who had a broken bone that healed. And we go, right. And then Graeber takes us through many, many great things. But he spent 10 years writing it, published it, or right before, and then died. Right? But he left us with humans never forget that human society has had the capacity to change, you know, from authoritarian to egalitarian.
Yeah.
keep that in your heart. He passed that to us, and you got great examples like Teotihuacan and everything, and pirates as a utopian society, right? So that realm of like community upsurge, and we can see it, right? You know, and we want to invite more. And I want to toss this to you too, which is the power of awakened betrayal, which is happening in this country, in which people who voted for Trump are like, whoa. It's a huge force, right? And I think that's also to all of us to be story crafters of invitation, going, yeah, here's a better story. Here's an inclusive story. You're right to the power of betrayal. What do you think of the power of realizing one has been betrayed as a powerful energy to be a fuel, really, to be guided?
I love David Graeber. I loved his work, and I use his work. And I love your metaphor of the story, right? Because it seems to me that when the story reveals not hope but betrayal, that's the condition for people for the change in public consciousness. That's a way in which people can re-examine not just simply their own sense of agency, but their own sense of community. And I want to go back to something earlier that you talked about that I think is really important, and that is we're starting to reclaim the recognition that these stories have to be told in spaces that become our spaces, not their spaces. You know, they can't be told in simply, you know, commodified coffee shops. I mean, they have to be told in universities and in public spaces in which people come together and exchange their stories so that they realize that those stories are not simply about them alone, suffering and feeling betrayed, but that this is a collective betrayal. This is a betrayal of the state. State terrorism is not only about betrayal, it's about what happens when betrayal believes it's no longer accountable, that the people who produce that betrayal. And so it seems to me that I'm always concerned about this relationship between an awakening, as Edward Said would talk about, a reawakening in ways in which people come back from the dead. You know, all of a sudden there's a sense of being alive because, as you say, history is open. And one of the things that Graeber does talk about, and it's very crucial, fascist societies don't last long.
Right.
I mean, something might be different in this case because they could destroy the planet with a nuclear war, if not something worse. And I'm not sure how much time we have left. But the fact of the matter is the contradictions that measure life against death are so overwhelming now that they've never been more clear, never, except maybe in fascist Germany or maybe in Chile or Argentina when Pinochet was alive. But the thing that I like now is that there is truly a crisis in authoritarian legitimation. And even people who voted for Trump are starting to realize it was a lie. That what we're seeing now is not a government that's going to be for working people. This is a government for the rich. I mean, you know, you're going to have 11 million people soon who are no longer going to have health insurance. You're going to have a national debt that's out of control. They can't defend this stuff. I mean, this woman the other day, you know, you saw the clip who when people said, well, what about people who don't have Medicaid or Medicare? That everybody dies. It's just a perfect metaphor. It's a metaphor for basically a death machine. And that's what we're dealing with. It's a death machine.
Well, we've had, again, people conned by their desire to not be conned, and now realizing they've been conned. But I think an important theme that you're bringing up also is that tyranny contains the seed of its own demise. Will it be in time? We're going to play with that. But we can see that already. Like the I Ching, when Trump was first elected, said, this is the darkest of poisons, where you put five venomous creatures in a jar until one of them kills and eats the others. I'm like, that's a pretty good analysis, I Ching. And now we see the kind of, you know, Elon's, just even since the falling out, you know, even more, lost another billion here or there. But the level of looting is so strong. But yeah, the time, you know, in pilot terminology, there's something called the time of useful consciousness. And it's the time you have between when the oxygen cuts out and you can still function, right? So in a way, it's like we're in the time of useful consciousness, right? And it's precious. You know, and in everything that everyone does, thinks, you know, feels, says is crucial, and that's the invitation. The story is an invitation. Aren't we all, you know, outraged by this? You know, And I like, you know, tyranny containing the seeds of its own demise, but it could be, could you make it faster, right? Because the level of destruction of the planet and the, right? And just to toss back to you too, the, you know, it is incumbent upon all of us to keep everyone safe, right? To keep Letitia James safe, always played her rousing speech, like, you know, to keep the Greta Thunberg and the people in the flotilla safe, right? Again, attention, stories, directed attention, going don't you dare, you know, to keep, you know, your position safe, to keep KPFA, you know, this dedication to safety, I think, you know, and just embracing, and that's what we're seeing in communities in which people, you know, facing danger, are standing up for each other. And we go, yes, that, more of that, right? So safety.
Yeah, I think the brutality and the violence that we're seeing is no longer hidden. I mean, I think the level of the sheer level of cruelty that this regime exhibits at all levels. I mean, arresting children on the way to school, abducting them and throwing them somewhere and people can't find them. These things are pretty hard to dispute. But I think that the question of safety has to be understood with respect to a couple of things. One, it has to be understood with a new sense of social responsibility and hope. You know, it has to be understood with the ability to basically take back the commons and spaces that basically were now turned over to the punishing state, where all problems were criminalized and social problems were sort of, you know, put under the blanket, and anybody who basically spoke out was seen as somehow an American or treasonous. And the white racism, of course, you know, the white supremacy sort of now emerging again. I mean, you think of Ye just producing a song called Hitler. I think that all of this safety comes with community, but it comes with the recognition that we need new forms of alliances and more direct forms and strategies that can shut the system down. We need direct action. I mean, elections are fine. I get it. Yes, they make a difference at a particular kind of level around school boards, mayors, and so forth and so on. But you need to stop the machine. You need to stop it. And it seems to me we have the power to stop it. The dock workers go on strike in this country, everything shuts down. And I think that we need to bring these different groups together. And in the name of safety, we need to add something, justice. And we need to add something else, compassion. And we need to add something else, struggle. And then we have to ask ourselves, what is it we're struggling against and what do we want? And how can we stop this state terrorism that is just completely out of control? And maybe the final question might be, what kind of future do we want for our children? I don't think about that. I mean, you know, it's, you know, all of us in some way have to think about a future that we bequest to people. And what does it mean to develop a new sense of solidarity, a new sense of safety, emboldened by a sense of civic courage, a sense of attentiveness to history, a sense of totality, a sense of struggle in which one's life could be in danger in that struggle? You know, the clip that you played earlier, which is so powerful. I mean, I don't want politics. Well, it isn't about politics. It's about whether or not you're going to live or die. It's about whether or not you're going to have a future. It's about whether you're going to turn your back on state terrorism. It's about whether you're going to believe that ICE is not basically a fascist army. And so we need a language that both in some way makes visible the horrors that we're confronting, but we need a new language for both what it means to talk about community safety and, most of all, collective struggle. We need a new narrative about democracy. We need to call it radical democracy so that it completely invalidates and makes clear what gangster capitalism does and how antithetical it is to any notion of hope and democracy. We can't do that. We're in trouble.
Well, I think, you know, you have much of James Baldwin, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful throughout the book. The book is The Burden of Conscience. But also a crucial print, there's no prison for the unexpected. And that means language too. If once heard it, if it's repeated, then there's a prison for it, or it's not heard. And so to play with that, you know, I was thinking about this, hearing somebody's podcast on nonviolent resistance, and I go, you know, those are three kind of vampire words: nonviolent and resistance. I go with Ursula Le Guin, who says we strengthen whatever we resist, and it's like, what are some other language of the thing? And then there's the 3.5% participation meme, which is if you get 3.5% participation, then they're going to change the thing. I'm inviting our listeners, citizen allies, accomplices, to go, what's some more to take over from nonviolent resistance, which is a good idea, but I think the language is like, anyway, back to yourself, but language. And then just for the fun of it, last time I hosted you many years ago, you know, but I go, what is pedagogy? And you taught me, it's the science of education. So just for the fun of it, everybody knows this, but maybe not everybody. What is your definition of neoliberalism?
My definition of neoliberalism is that it's a system that basically concentrates wealth and power in the hands of relatively few people. And it does that not just simply by building monopolized educational structures that basically redefine almost every aspect of life, but it creates an educational system that basically depoliticizes people. It claims that the market, for instance, is the template for all social relations, that the only thing that matters are relationships that basically can engage and exchange values. It engages in an absolutely reductive notion of individualism. It separates economic activity from social responsibility, and it functions in such a way as to basically lead people to believe that the only thing that matters is agreed consumption and the accumulation of capital. It's a death march. It's a death machine.
Why is it called liberalism?
Called neoliberalism because liberalism basically argued that in some way you had to modify the excesses of capitalism, that social rights mattered, that the welfare state in some way matters. Neoliberalism says all of that is nonsense. Neoliberalism is Milton Friedman on steroids. When Friedman makes the claim along with Hayek and others that social responsibility is an evil, and that the only purpose that government really has is to enable market exchanges and to benefit the wealthy, then you're into something far more dangerous than liberalism. Liberalism is willing to say we have to have some limits on capitalism. Neoliberalism says we have no limits on capitalism, none whatsoever. And hence, it eventually produces in a much greater way forms of inequality, rationales for white supremacy, rationales for bigotry and hate, unlike anything we've ever seen before. That's what's new. You don't want to confuse a system that basically in some way supports the social state, the welfare state, with a system, but at the same time only supports it to basically enable capitalism to exist, particularly in the fight against what it calls socialism. Neoliberalism says, hey, look, any notion of social responsibility is communism. Any notion of government that should in some way benefit the undeserved is completely unacceptable. It's a system so much more brutal in its disregard for human life and its disregard for justice and its disregard for any notion of equality that it, as I said before, it's an incredible death machine. It's worse than the divine right of kings.
So I think we need new words for neoliberalism because it's used everywhere. It's used everywhere, which means it's lost its oof, and it also sort of goes over. Well, anyway, I'm just putting it into the cauldron, going because everything you just said, you know, again is fresh. It's brutality. It's the abdication of your own autonomy. It's like I'm just concerned citizens for refreshing language, right? And just playing with it. As we spiral it forth, and I do just for the fun of it, because I can't help myself, Henry, is, you know, I have your birth chart here. And when you were born, Uranus, trickster genius, which is the keeper of democracy, is at 8 Gemini. And when this country, America, was born, Uranus was at 8 Gemini. It's exactly, you are humming with the spirit of democratic intelligence right in you. And its image is a quiver filled with arrows, which you certainly have. And I think that's for all of us. There are so many ways to participate in the fate of the world. And I like the quiver filled with arrows, you know, and I like myself. Everybody can dress it up, you know, each arrow tipped with compassion, with tyranny as its target. Fatum, fatum, fatum. So I just wanted to animate that you have a quiver filled with arrows and you are tied to the democratic impulse, the positive impulse in this country. So thank you for that. So I just wanted to put that in there. So yes, and then you know the the word delusional, right? De ludo means out of the game, which I think is useful. De ludo. So, you know, you mentioned many important things. Again, you know, we're aware of the horror, but there's always more, you know, and I think for all of us, you know, a friend taught me this a long, long time ago, which is to talk across borders, to find a common story. No one minds being asked, did you know? Did you know that 2,400 students have been arrested by police since May 5th? You know, did you know? And people go, oh, I didn't know that. Did you know that the, you know, Kuwaitis were slant drilling oil into Iraq? You know, did, oh, I didn't know it. Did you know, you know, that whatever? And as part of our quiver, a part of our expanding skills of conversation across borders, because it's non-polarity, you know, and polarity feeds tyranny. And part of our task is that tyranny does horrible things, which makes us go, you know, which it feeds on, right? Empire feeds on division and strife and violence, you know, and so it's like, so how to spiral out of that? And I think the question, and, you know, and part of your dedication to a tradition of pedagogy, you know, is questions, right? I mean, you're still teaching, right?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
Well, God love you. That's right. That's great. So you use questions, right?
I mean, I think that when you talk about pedagogy, you're talking about a kind of an awakening, right? You're talking about a pedagogy that basically is a project, and that project is to expand the possibility for young people to think in ways that they haven't thought before, and to do that in a way that expands their own sense of agency and sense of possibility, and to give them the sense that being critical matters and questioning matters. And that a cultural questioning is good for a democracy, and that we have to raise, fundamental kinds of questions about why some people are allowed to question and some people are not, and we have to raise fundamental questions about what it means to think outside of yourself, to in some way not buy into the neoliberal logic. If you, or call it what you want, gangster capitalism, the notion that privatism is the only thing that matters, and economics is the only thing that should drive politics, and that markets can regulate themselves, and that people don't have to be held accountable. Around the language of justice, equality, and inclusion. And I think that what pedagogy in its best sense does is it rouses a sense of agency that can't be confined by the institution. It helps to raise questions that basically aren't raised. It helps people to be, helps individuals to be more critical about, in some way, coming to grips with something fundamental. And that is that what education really should be doing, what pedagogy really is about, is the acquisition of agency. The ability to struggle with ongoing relations of power, and that it's a precondition for creating informed and critical citizens. It should be a place where students realize themselves as citizens, as empowered agents. That's what it should be. It should raise questions about the relationship between democracy and learning and education and having an informed judgment. It should teach young people that in some way the struggle over education is also the struggle over power. It's a struggle over agency. The struggle of assigned meanings, and it illuminates the relationship between what is and what ought to be, and we should always err on the side of what ought to be.
Yes, right. Well, now we're back to we're picking things from everywhere, like 1968, Paris. You know, all power to the imagination. You know, and again, you quote and you express yourself in The Burden of Conscience. You know, again, that it's the suppression of imagination. Once you suppress and imprison people's imagination into toxic passive celebrity or anything, then you know the game is over. But I like also the Finite and Infinite Games by James Carse. You know, a finite game's about winning, infinite games about keeping everything and everyone in play, as part of our aspiration.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, that's terrific. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, there's a certain element on the left, you know, that's kind of stillborn, right? They don't want to talk about the imagination. They think it's too cushy. They think that it doesn't really say anything. But it seems to me that the real struggle over justice is really the struggle over imagining a different society where justice is possible, right? I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, I think of Ernst Bloch, you know, who wrote three volumes on dreaming and hope, you know, who said without hope, there's no sense of agency. Without agency, there's no sense of hope. And we're not talking about Disney-like hope. We're not talking about a hope that in some way is so stupid that, you know, it reduces itself to saying, well, God will do it or Allah will do it or whatever. It's a kind of hope that is really rooted in Frederick Douglass's notion of struggle, that you can't have struggle unless you can imagine something different. And you can't imagine something different unless you can imagine a readjusted and redefined notion of justice itself.
Well, yeah, and the Bengtsson's wonderful group, they have a line in their song, they go, hope is not a feeling, hope is an action.
Absolutely. But I want to, I interrupt for a minute? I want to go back to this. You had raised the question of language, right?
Yes.
And, you know,
I'm
reading Noguchi lately. I'm going back and reading Noguchi and reading Gayatri Spivak on language. And I think there's something there that we often forget, because in repressed societies, language is really about the flattening out of communication. But it really isn't. It's really not just about communication. It's also about the shaping of identities. It's about the shaping of agency. And it's never removed from questions of power, because there are institutions that define what language counts and what language doesn't. And I think that what this discourse about the imagination raises with respect to language is what's missing. What's missing?
Well, yeah, and also, you know, the opposite of aesthetic is anesthetic. So great conversation I had with James Hillman a long time ago. But we go, opposite of aesthetic is anesthetic. So if you don't have a living sense of beauty, which is also kinship, you're anesthetized, which means you can't have a democracy, you're asleep. So there's really no solution to anything without beauty. We're putting this on, you know, and the old lefty grumpitudinous thing. And it's like, I think that's waning, you know, even in absolute progressive KPFA, it's like, no, we're moving towards participatory animism, really, and beauty and culture that you brought that up. You know, so the aesthetic and the anesthetic and the imagination and culture, which is, you know, art and that which makes us what do we love and how do we love and how do we protect that, and all of those conversations we have less than a minute left. I want to just hand it to you. What is your woof exhortation?
I think that one of the things that we have to realize is that in dark times, you always have to have a sense of hope. And one of the things that I see happening all around me is I see young people who, with their bodies, I mean, protest is not just about language, it's also about activities, but it's also about your body. And I think that even in the discourse I've just heard coming from you, you know, in talking about the imagination, that has to be embodied, right? We have to have a new sense of how the body matters, how collective struggle matters, how community matters. And I think that these young people today, so many of them are so aware that they've been canceled out of the future, and so aware that when we talk about injustice, it's not simply confined to specific borders, that we're in a new sense of movement internationally and globally, a movement in which we're creating generations of border crossers who are talking to each other, trying to figure out what the new language might look like and how to produce it collectively and what these struggles might look like and what new strategies are left. So for me, as somebody who's near the end of his life, I mean, I look back and I think they give me hope. They give me hope to realize that I may not be able to change anything in terms of what I would like to see right now, but they will. And that keeps me going.
Yeah, no, we're still in this. Anyway, we're on our way out. Thank you so much, Henry Giroux. We're all becoming agents of liberating trickster. May it be so. Thank you, Henry. Thank you always to Kirsten Thomas, Skookum Board Up. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. Woof, woof, woof. Thank you, team.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.